listener production.
Shares.
Market.
The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that doesn't have a casino license in New South Wales. I'm Scott Phillips. He is Andrew Page, of course, of strawmen.com. How are you, Andrew?
Very good, sir. Very good, sir.
Or Ram, as I prefer to call you.
Yeah, that's right.
Andrew Ram Page.
Ram Page. I love it.
I'm just excited our listeners are enjoying it. Almost every, well, probably two out of three questions we get is addressed to me and to Scott and Ram, which I very much appreciate. Tickles my fancy. How are you, mate?
Yeah, pretty good. Look, as we were just talking about off air, it's a bit of a meh week at the moment.
A real meh week.
It's just not a lot happening. And that's not a bad thing. It's not a bad thing at all, in fact.
Unless you've got to do a podcast every week talking about the news of the week.
Well, that makes it a bit trickier.
We're the ones in some trouble. Just quietly there, mate, you said before, oh, it's okay if the podcast is a bit shorter than normal. I said, no, it's not going to be shorter than normal. You and I can talk, and we will try and make it relevant. There's been a few things in the news, mate. Not a lot of worried about the lack of company news. It's not really a worry or not a worry, really. Just noting the fact that there's been almost nothing going on in company land. There's a couple of things we'll talk about. Is it the calm before the storm, I suppose, is my question to you. Because we're literally recording this 7 full days from the end of the financial year. Confession season, that, you know, so let's wind it back. Earnings season is the horrible cliched name we give to when companies put their profit announcements out, their annual reports or half-year reports, and they have to come out within 2 months of the end of the financial year. So they'll be out probably in August because they don't, you know, it's hard to pull together, it takes a while. So it won't be in July, it'll be August. So August is, air quotes, earnings season. I'll say officially earnings season with a smile because there's nothing official about it. Same as nothing official about a bear market, but we call them official anyway. So that's earnings season. Before that, companies who've said, oh, everything's going to be fine, and then kind of go, oh, I've only got a week to go. Oh, no. Oh, this is going to be bad. Then that we have, before earnings season, confession season. Mm. Is this the calm before the confession season storm, mate?
Well, there's got to be some revisions. Like, it might not all be bad, but I mean, you've made the point really well before that, you know, companies forget that they don't have to actually give us guidance, right?
Oh,
they
don't
have
to. That ref. Yeah.
You know, a lot of people listen and they go, what do you mean? Of course they do. You know, they need to keep the market informed. It's like, well, they do need to keep the market informed. Mm. And anything that they can reasonably inform us on, they should.
Yep.
But what this is a bit hard to get your head around because you think that the people on the inside know it all.
Mm-hmm.
But anyone, again, who's run a business, and you ask the local cafe owner, you know, what are you going to, like, so on July 1, what are you going to be reporting on June 30 next year? Mm. They'll give you their best guess, but it's probably going to be wrong. Not because they're liars, not because they're idiots, just because it's really hard to predict the future. Even if you are on the inside, you're calling the shots, you mate, it's really, really hard. But there's huge pressure from analysts and the market to do so.
Mm.
And it's just become this thing where people feel as though they have to. Mm. And so they do. They put it out there. And then, you know, things either go a bit better than you expect or a bit worse. So then you have to inform the market again and saying, well, I know we said this, but now we think that. Mm. And there is all kinds of recriminations. But, you know, look at Twitter. It's like, oh, you said this. What a con man. You know, absolute fraud. They're huckster. You know, it's like, well, yeah, I don't know. Not everything's a conspiracy, right? Like sometimes the mistake, if there's a mistake, is trying to put something out there as certain. Now, there are some businesses that have very, very reliable earnings, and you can probably be more realistic and do it. Other businesses, just by nature, hyper-cyclical and just very, very difficult to forecast. So there are some businesses out there that just go, no, we don't do that. It's policy. We just don't do it. We'll tell you everything about how the business is going, what our strategic plans are, our positioning, all of this kind of stuff. But yeah, we're not going to give you any guidance. And by the way, note to any analysts that are listening here, that's your job, right? Mm. Like the company's not there to do your job. If you feel as though that's really important for what you need to do, then do it.
Yep.
It's not the company's job to do yours. So anyway.
I get upset about a lot of things. No, I exercise about a lot of things. I don't get upset. I'm actually a pretty happy bloke. Giving guidance is the world's most stupid thing. Unless you have literally 95% of your revenue contracted for the next year, in which case, sure, share that information. Brad Banducci, the CEO of Woolworths, has no idea how much people are going to spend in Big W on the 52nd week of the next financial year.
No.
And yet he feels compelled, and this is not about Brad. Brad's a very decent guy, good guy, good executive. Feels compelled to tell the market what to expect from Woolworths next year. And so you say, well, hang on, if you can't know, then A, what are you doing? And B, how do you make a number? So it's all best guesses. And even when you say, well, they should be able to tell, like, really? I mean, even if the strategy is going to change meaningfully, and they know that, and so they have, how do you know whether the strategy is going to work? And if you don't know if it's going to work, or you're not going to change strategy, then it's your guess same as everybody else's guess, because it is what it is, right? Like, maybe the trends are a little more clear internally because they've got data that's not released to the markets, and maybe there's that. Here's, you know why I really, really, really hate guidance, though, is because of the adverse, perverse impact it has on people inside the organizations. Because it becomes this stupid short-term goal-chasing behavior. Because we told the market X, and so come hell or high water, and General Electric GE under Jack Welch was a classic for this. I quite like some of Jack's writing. But they used to beat Wall Street estimates by a cent every single time.
Yeah.
And there was nothing illegal and nothing even super dodgy about it, but they would do whatever they had to do to beat Wall Street estimates by a cent.
Just dig into that. So that, well, they might bring sales forward a little bit, you know.
Yeah, something, or they'd sell something, or they'd pull out some expenses, or they'd do whatever needed to happen just to get. And so, that's exactly the point, mate, is that, you know, if we sit here as investors, and investors, by definition, the phrase, as David Gardner says, long-term investing should be a tautology. Investing should be long-term by definition.
Mm.
If you're an investor, you want the value of your business to be worth more in 10 years' time, and some CEO says to his or her staff, hey guys, go out there and do whatever you have to do to get the sales number this month because it's the end of the quarter, end of the half, and I need to tell. It's like, really? And I have worked for businesses who've done exactly this. Like crystal clear examples where it's like, no one does it deliberately to say, oh, stuff the long term. They kind of all believe, they tell themselves, we'll fix it the long term and it's only a short term problem, but we'll fix it next half and we'll do some more things, or we'll push the sales team harder, or we'll do whatever. We'll make it up to them. We'll try and fix it. And sometimes you do. Sometimes you get away with it. Other times you just dig a deeper and deeper and deeper hole. And the next poor CEO comes in and goes, oh, Jesus, I guess I've got to fix this thing then. And that's, you know, we kind of laugh at CEOs coming in and taking what they call big bath, you know, writing everything off and resetting everything.
Clean slate.
Yeah, and look, often they're being cynical. Often it is literally just the case of like, you were doing what? I'm not going to keep doing that. That's ridiculous. I get a chance to actually fix this once and for all. I'm going to do it now when I take over and stop all this rubbish. And I've been for businesses where every year the discounts you give customers to get higher and higher and higher and higher and higher. Why? Because you had a sales number to meet every time. And screw the long-term brand value. Screw the long-term sales momentum. Who cares? Worry about that next year. Right now, I've just got to get a number so I can make the ASX. It's just mad. Like, it's complete stupidity. And CEOs know that deep down. They just can't help themselves.
It's counterproductive. It's counterproductive.
And that's pretty polite.
And yeah, yeah. So, full circle. Yeah. Yes, we are coming into confession season, and we are gonna see some of this stuff kind of happen.
Yeah. Do you have any inklings of what you think we might see, or from who, or by what, for what?
I suspect that if in any direction, there'll be downgrades.
Okay.
And that's because some of these forecasts were made a while ago, and since then the world has moved in a certain direction. The input costs for almost all businesses have gone up, even if it's just fuel or power.
Mm-hmm.
But even raw materials, logistics costs, wage pressures, they've all gone up, right? Mm-hmm. And that's gonna impact things.
Mm.
So I suspect that is going to be the case. And again, this is just me shooting the breeze here.
Yeah.
I've got no idea, but I wouldn't also be surprised if the market's reaction was overly harsh, because the market is in a brittle,
nervous. You don't want to put a downgrade out at the moment, do you? Let's be honest.
Yeah. Look. When everything is firing and things are just shooting to the moon, you can kind of, there's a bit of bad news, and people will look at it glass half full.
Yeah.
The market is very much looking at it glass half full at the moment. Yeah. So it's
half empty.
I've seen it actually. I'm trying to think of the names now, but companies was just like they have pulled back their guidance by 3 or 4% at the midpoint, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And shares will drop 20%.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Whoa. Yes. Whoa. Yes. Okay. You know, not as good as we thought. And maybe, look, others, people might say yes, but actually it points to deeper structural problems, and maybe there's truth to that in some circumstances, but. I feel as though
you and I know better than that.
Yeah, I actually think they're interesting dynamics, because it is something that is potentially an opportunity. Mm-hmm. Where
yes, absolutely.
You know, the market just throws its toys out of the cot.
Yeah,
and on news that is objectively bad, like question. Yeah. It's like, okay, we are now earning less than we thought we were going to for this particular year, maybe even for the year after. I mean, that's not good news. I'm not going to try and spin it that way.
Yeah.
But it probably, we've often said the real value of a business is the sum of all its future cash flows, right? Yep. Pure and simple, adjusted for inflation and what return you might want to get from those cash flows. That's exactly. It.
Yep.
And so, okay, we're going to earn 5-10% less this year, next year, year after that. You add that all up from mm-hmm. here till kingdom come. It's actually a tiny difference in any intrinsic value calculation. Oh,
it's a madness, isn't it? Like you think about the size of the decline compared to, it's really, really bizarre.
It's crazy. It's crazy. It really is. And yet the market will, because it's so short-term focused, we'll see very big falls. So it can be an opportunity. The key thing, as I've touched on, is to understand what you're talking about is, you know, just the normal bumps in the road, the normal cyclicalities, the cut and thrust of business, and not, we're facing a long-term existential decline because the business is no longer relevant.
It's bizarre.
That's the key. That is absolutely the key.
Can I talk about the impact of that, mate? Because we do temperament regularly, and we have lots of questions about what next, what to think, how to think, how to invest, all that kind of stuff. And so I just want to describe in my own mind my thoughts. What can happen in the way investors tend to react. So you talk about the big falls, the big 10, 15, 20% falls on a given day. And you say, if those falls are overdone relative to the decline in the business, which are often the case, there can be an opportunity for investors. The problem is then the what comes next. And there is no easy answer to this, and there's no even easy way to explain it, because it all comes down to, frankly, random chance and the human tendency to perceive meaning or to assign meaning and then to try and recognize patterns that aren't there. Mm. So let me unpack that. If we see company X pages, paper pens fall by 15% on the sense that profit's down 2%, right? You say, hang on, that sounds pretty good to me. I think pages, paper pens looks cheap enough to buy. That's an overreaction. There's value being created or potential value being created for investors by overlooking the short-term dramas and buying the long-term business. What comes next either is, and this is obvious, but let's go with it, either the shares keep falling or they bounce back. And so the investor, and this is where we get in our own ways as investors, right? Because we're so desperately keen to avoid any losses and we're so keen to prove we're smart by picking the bottom, which is just the world's worst phrase, that we kind of get ourselves tangled up in knots. Because someone looks at it and goes, but they'll probably keep falling. I'll wait till they keep falling. Or someone says, oh, they're going to bounce back. Or you know, and whatever happens next, we kind of somehow think there's going to be value. So the investor who says, okay, well, it's fallen 15%, but now it'll probably keep falling because the market hates it. I'm not going to buy the shares yet. And sometimes it keeps falling. See, I told you, other times it bounces back and they go, oh, I missed it. And that whole idea of being so desperate to assume we might know what comes next or to avoid the losses. If a business falls 15%, then another 5%, and then goes back up 50%, of course, we'd rather wait, but if you didn't know, wouldn't you rather have bought at 15% discount and then get the 50% upside anyway, rather worry about where it goes next in the short term? And so, because there's so much of that, mate, the conversation, and the reason I say it, we hear this so regularly, right? Oh, it's fallen, the market hates it. I'm going to wait till the market starts liking this thing again. Or whatever else it is that we want to pretend
all
we
the think time
we can know. And it's just completely unknowable. Like, it is completely unknowable. And so I just want to throw that out because, you know, and look, no one likes it. I bought shares when I thought they were cheap and they keep falling and they keep falling and they keep falling.
Dude, like, every time I buy shares, they drop the next
right,
day.
Right, right. And you think,
I'm the ultimate reverse indicator. I should sell a newsletter, which is whenever I buy, I'm going to tell you when I'm going to buy a share.
And then
it just means that you just wait a little bit and you'll get a much cheaper than I do.
Exactly. So, and that's kind of, you know, that's right, the Andrew plus two strategy or something. There is no so what other than to just remind our listeners that Don't try and pick the bottom because it's dumb and no one can ever do it. So you're wasting your time. But also too, if you get presented with value is value no matter what happens in the short term next. Yeah. And you can't know. So this is pure looking gift horse in the mouth stuff. If someone says to you, hey, here's a dollar, would you like to pay me 80 cents for it? And you say, no, I might wait in case it's 75 cents at some point.
That's the point I was just going to make.
Cool.
So the way I think about it is, let's say I've done a lot of work on a business. I feel as though I understand it really well. And it'll probably be worth 10 bucks in five years' time.
Yep.
And I get that number processes we've talked before, but, you know, basically what they're earning, how the market might judge. You know, it's a guess. It's a total guess, for whatever reason, I've come up with that number. Now, if I want a 10% return, well, I just divide that 10 by 1.1 again and again and again five times. It comes out to $6.21.
There you go. Well done.
So my calculus is if the market, or not is where is the market going to go, it's where is it now? Is it at that value?
Right.
Is it at $6.21?
Yep.
If so, I'll buy it. Why? Because I'll get the return that I want.
Yep.
If it's at if it then drops to $5, like, great. Actually, now I'm going to get, now my return's even better. What matters to me is whenever a piece of news comes out, it's like, how does that impact my future estimate of value? That's the key thing. Mm. I'd love to be able to pick it in the turning point, but that's the North Star. And that impacts everything. Enough. Sometimes news will come out and I go, oh, what the hell was I thinking? $10? I should have said $8 because I got that. Yeah. I got made a fund, and then I'll readjust, and that will adjust what I do. But as long as that other number remains unchanged, that's the one that I want to anchor on, not what the market is doing. And you want to know what? Let's say I do that. Let's say I buy at $6.20, and then it is actually at $10 in 5 years' time. I mean, does it really matter if it goes to $1 between then and now? I mean, it matters for if I like to have a good night's sleep. That matters.
That's why it matters, exactly.
And that's why it does matter, I suppose, on that front. But I'm still getting my 10% return, which I said was adequate for me.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I got my 10% return, plus I got an opportunity to lock in, like, you know, 50% returns as well, because it went down. That's the North Star. That's what you need to focus on. Super easy for me to articulate. Incredibly difficult to do, which is why so few people do it, and why so few people get it wrong or get it right.
Yeah, that's right. And look, I just think it's important because the idea of being, you know, penny wise and pound foolish really is what describes that sort of behavior of, like, you know, it's dropped from $1 to 75 cents. I won't buy it in case it goes to 70. So it's not so obvious. We're not given an absolute dollar at absolutely 75 cents. We're given a $5 share price on a business we think might be worth $6.21, to use your example, right? So sometimes you get that opportunity and you go, okay, well, okay, fine. If it goes to $4.50 or $4, well, okay, you might go, oh, it's a shame, I could have bought it cheaper. But that literally should be just, oh, it's a shame. Not I'm going to wait just in case I can get it cheaper. It's just human nature is, we are not very good at this process. So roughly right, but it's precisely wrong. We've said it so many times.
Perfect is the enemy of good. Truth.
Right, exactly. Yep. Anyway, long way just to describe the fact that if you see a share price sell off, if it goes cheaper from there, so be it, right? I've said before, well, let's mention it for fun, right? One more time before I go on holidays, we'll talk about Kogan. The shares are now at, like, well, I don't know what they are, $3-ish. I don't look at my portfolio. People are always surprised I don't know the price of these things. I just don't. Shares are about $3, right? Did I like them at $5? Yes. Does it suck they're now $3? Yes. Am I having people tell me I'm so badly wrong because the shares have fallen? Absolutely, yes. Do I like that? No. Let's get those questions out of the way early. But if I'm right, this is a $10 stock or something at some point, then, you know, of course I'm disappointed it went to $3 before it goes back to 10. Now, if it never goes to 10, it goes to 1 and stays there, then I'm wrong anyway. Whether I bought it 5 or 3, $1 still losing most of my money, right? But it's just, you know, where it goes on the way through is just completely immaterial. It's a shame. I wish it didn't. It sucks. I'd like it to go straight up, please. That'd be lovely. But yeah, just kind of drives me a little bit spare that I'm not even blaming people for doing it, because, as you say, mate, sleepless nights, and we worry about it. But here's the I'll finish with this. Feel free to add up. I'll finish with this. We as investors say, I'm going to buy shares because I think the market is wrong about this company.
Mm-hmm.
Thereafter, we assume the market's right. I like Kogan at $5. Just pick a number, right? Because I think the market's wrong about Kogan. It goes to 3. Oh my God, the market's right. It's $3. It's like, what did I, like, when did I all of a sudden assign the market some prescience between the time I said it was wrong, so I bought the shares, and now all of a sudden I think the market's wised up and finally got it right, and all of a sudden now I'm wrong? Like, just the cognitive dissonance of just that process alone is enough to remind us, I hope, that you've just got to cool your jets.
Yeah. Yep. So one qualifier to what you're saying is that if the shares, you buy at 5 and then it goes to 3,
yep,
but Ruslan comes out and says, actually, I've made a huge mistake. I bought all this stuff. I did all this. And that's different, right? Yep. So we're not saying, and this is where I think people get confused. We're not saying, oh, don't worry about when share prices go down.
It's like, don't
automatically worry when share prices come down. So as we go into this earnings or confession season and you see some news come out and the share price fall, just go and read the announcement and put that in context of what does that mean for the business. It may be that, in fact, this happens to me a bit, where it's actually, objectively, I am lowering my valuation on that. But I still won't do anything because it just turns out that while I may have gone from $10 to $9.50 in my valuation, the share price has gone from $8 to $6. Yeah, so it's still a positive thing.
Yes.
And the other thing I would say too is that there's a wonderful T.S. Eliot quote, which is, it's the journey, it's not the destination, which is just such a wonderful quote for life. It's a really bad quote for investing, because with investing, it's the destination, it's not the journey. I would flip it around entirely because the journey is going to be it's not going to be a fun journey, right? But you're going to do it anyway because the destination is going to be awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's move on, because it was a worthwhile conversation, mate. Let's go back to the macro for a second. It's tempting to think that central bankers around the world are having this kind of chest beating, hold my beer conversation and trying to outdo each other, because we're recording this on Thursday morning, as we always do. Wednesday night, our time, Jerome Powell, Jay Powell, the US Fed chair. The headline, a big whack across the side of the head to the headline writers too. Headline reads, Powell refuses to rule out 100 basis point interest rate increase.
Rule out. God, I hate the rule out, rule in.
That's nonsense. Yeah, exactly. So, and massive props to Jay Powell, right? He's done exactly what he should have done. He was asked at a Senate committee meeting, right, in the US. Can you rule this out? He said, no, I'm not going to rule anything out. Which is exactly
why would you? Maybe the nuclear missile is launched tomorrow. I don't know. I'm not going to rule. Oh, but you ruled that
it's
out.
Stupidity. Like, yeah, well, it's absolute stupidity.
Things change, man.
So yes, that was exactly the point I wanted to make in terms of the headlines. Just a dumb headline. But they have talked about potentially. Two things. First, potentially raising rates by 0.75%. Actually, that is on the table. So not only are they not ruled out higher, but this is on the table. This is an active consideration, which is something, right? That's an actual positive point to make rather than not ruling out anything else. So there's that. On top of that, what I thought was more interesting is they have basically said they think they'll probably front load this. So they're going to put rates up fast and hard early to get towards neutral really fast. So we're on this sequential. This is a question we've had a lot of times from a lot of people. Well, if the RBA is going to put rates up by X, why don't they just do it now and get it over and done with? And it's actually what the US Fed is basically talking about potentially doing. Just saying, look, this is, you know, we need to get back to some sort of more neutral level. Doing it slowly is a waste of time. We're going to do it. We're going to do it now and do it fast. Now, the US Fed has a benefit, or in this case, it's a cost or a downside when rates are falling for them. They have more Americans, most Americans, in fact, on fixed rate mortgages. So the impact on the US economy of rate rises is nowhere near as significant in terms of the literal impact on spending. For every whatever quarter of a point rise, for example, there's just simply less of an impact in the US than there is here, because most of the Yanks are on fixed rates, which means they don't actually get impacted by those rate changes. And so they go, oh, whatever, who cares, doesn't matter. Whereas here, most people are on variables, and so the RBA here has a much greater and more direct, more immediate impact on the economy. So there is that. But just that was interesting, mate, that they've kind of pretty much gone, hey, this is, you know, it's changing the pace of what they might be doing. Partly, I think, again, mate, because inflation continues to be high, 9% in the UK during the week. Inflation.
That's the trimmed mean, blah 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 blah. Like, you know, there's you throw in energy and stuff, often gets excluded because it's so volatile. But yeah, I mean, you know, show me someone who doesn't use energy, and I'll show you a unicorn. Like I don't know if you filled up your car recently.
Yeah. I have.
It's a real cost.
With diesel just quietly, which is worse than you pass on unleaded. There was a time diesel was cheap. Now it's more expensive than unleaded.
It's just so 9% on the standard sort of measure. I would suspect it's more than that for the average household. Mm-hmm. In fact, the government over there is actually sending out, I guess for all intents and purposes, stimulus checks to help households meet their energy costs and stuff. So it's it's pretty serious, stuff. Yeah. I suspect the Fed is going to try and tip the economy into recession on purpose because it's the lesser of two evils.
Yeah.
We want a soft land. I mean, the reality is they can't let interest rates. I don't think interest rates will get too high. I think they'll do a big scary moves early.
Yeah,
put the fear of God into people. Mm-hmm. Probably tip it into a bit of a recession. Mm-hmm. I mean, they just won't be able to raise money or afford their debt if they let interest rates go up. That's what's different now to in the past. It's just like we can't. This is why the burden of debt does ultimately matter at a point. You've painted yourself into a corner. If rates were to get way too high, you bankrupt the government essentially, or the government just gets out of it by printing more money essentially, in which you get hyperinflation.
Adds inflation, correct? Exactly. And that's
so. So you it's this horrendous rock and a hard place.
Yeah.
So I mean, they would never say this because they don't want to have another march on the Capitol. but they're going to try and tip the economy into a recession and cross their fingers that it's a reasonably mild one.
Yeah, I will say I would give a slightly different version of your comment, which is I think they will happily run the risk of doing it. I don't think they're going to deliberately doing it, as in I don't know they would target a recession as the end goal. Personally, you may disagree, which is fine. I think they're saying we are going to go and try and cause a recession. I think they're saying we will do whatever we have to do, and if it causes a recession, then so be it.
Yeah.
So I think probably to my mind, that's probably. You can have to have a different view, but yeah, I think that's more likely. And they've effectively said as much. They're just like, this will be painful, this will hurt. And we've talked about this before, so it's not new news from us either. But just a real reminder, and you've set up beautifully the risks that they face by not doing the work properly. And so they're going to do what they have to do to make sure that, they get inflation back under control. Because getting out of control, you reckon high interest rates suck. You wait till you see inflation get out of control. that's the stuff that no one's going to be able to cope with. And
inflation is a tax.
Yeah.
Let's be clear about that. I mean, it's not just this economic.
But it's worse. We did nothing for it.
It is collectively robbing all of us of our savings and our purchasing power.
That's right.
It's exactly what it is. It's a really horrible, horrible thing. A little bit, 2-3% people will say is good.
Yep.
I'm actually coming around. I don't even know if that's true anymore. I'm starting to doubt that. But anyway, it's sort of there's a strong argument for that. But at the rates that we are seeing at the moment, and as we've said before, these are not because people are getting out of control with their spending. These are more supply led kind of things, outside of the Fed's control. So. Yep.
But it's the implication, but why they're doing something about it, and this is the question we get a lot, is hang on, if it's all about oil prices, why is the RBA trying to do something? Why is the Fed trying to do something? And the answer is the feedback loops.
Yeah.
Because if you let inflation become endemic, even no matter where it comes from, in fact, actually, so interesting enough, mate, Governor Lowe actually talked about this, I think it was this week.
Yeah, he did. And
he basically said it is now becoming local. So he said, inflation was global. Now it's becoming local. In other words, the feedback loops they're seeing are starting to actually come to into fruition. And that's their big issue. It's like, you know what? Yep, it sucks that it's coming from overseas. Yes, it sucks that it's supply. If we let it become part of effectively demand, then that stuff gets real, real fast at that point. And that's what they're trying to stamp down.
Yep. Can I go? Please. I'm going to blow your mind a little bit here because this is not my.
Here we go.
It's not my.
Can I tell you, mate? You've set a high bar there. You've absolutely sold the lead. So if it's not as good as you hope it's going to be, you're going to disappoint a whole lot of listeners. But anyway, go on. Try and blow my mind. I'll see.
I am seriously considering investing in energy companies, oil and gas.
Companies. Look out.
And it's always been something I've never had any interest in. And let's put the ethical thing aside.
Yeah.
And that I just don't want to get into it, but I will just say it is important to me, right? Yep. It's not an industry I want to support.
You know my view on ethical investing. I'm not going to criticize you for buying shares in an oil company.
It's a whole other conversation, but I don't want to have that conversation. Yep. but even when you move that aside, the reason I've never found it palatable is that they're extraordinarily capital intensive industries.
Yeah. Yep.
So you've got to spend hundreds of millions of dollars over very long periods of time, and eventually you get some money out of it. And the money that you get is highly uncertain because you'll be selling on this commodity on an international market. You'll have a certain cost of production, which you'll do your best to estimate, but the estimate will probably be wrong. And you have no idea what it's going to be. So it might be that by the time the oil is ready to sell, it's $200 a barrel or it's $50 a barrel. It's a huge difference, right? So they're very difficult businesses, very difficult. And history shows that. It's not me just making this proclamation. History will support me on that. But this is why I think it's interesting at the moment. And it's not because oil prices are high, because, you know, you would sort of say eventually there'll be a supply side response. But why I think it's interesting is that there will be there at the moment, no one is investing because there's a very strong ESG sort of push and mandate here.
So when we say investing, you're talking about investing in new capacity rather than buying shares.
I'm talking about buying shares.
Oh, right. Okay. So no one's buying shares because of ESG. Okay, cool. Yep.
So multiples in these areas are actually lower than they've been historically because big sovereign funds, super funds, it's just like, oh, we've got this ESG mandate. We can't invest in oil and gas anymore. Okay, the multiple goes lower, right? For whatever, for good or ill, it just goes better. Mm-hmm. The companies themselves are going, well, I'm not going to commit to a decade-long, you know, $2 billion project. Yeah. Why am I doing that? Yeah. So this, you know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of the tobacco companies. So you've got a situation where I've got very, very low multiples. In other words, I'm getting a very high very high earnings yield on these businesses. And also, in the past, that might not have been still not attractive because any earnings that I get are going to be reinvested. Because they're not going to be reinvested, there's no regulatory or political certainty. There's all kinds of things, reasons as to why they wouldn't. There's a big transition underway with renewables. So it's actually you're actually going to get a high free cash flow yield. So I'm going to get I'm going to buy deliberately long term. I'm thinking of buying deliberately long term into a business like this because I'm getting a very high free cash flow yield. Where even if the earnings decline over time, as they have with tobacco, where sales have just been the smoking rates have just been going down year after year after year for the last 50 years, and yet you've done incredibly well because and the key here is there's two keys here. Firstly, you've got to have a company that has established production. And two, you've got a management who is who is committed to running it for cash. Now, that might really reduce your opportunity set.
Right.
But I think if you can find that, I'm going to probably get very high yields, companies who buy their dividends back, which means I get even better yields. And it won't that I do particularly that much on the share price from, but overall with my income and my gains from buybacks, I'll probably do really well over time. What do you think? Should I do it?
Fascinating, mate.
It's an interesting idea, right?
It is a very interesting idea. So the thing you didn't necessarily
told you I'd blow your mind.
And you were right. And by the way, listen, we haven't talked about this. This is genuinely new news. I'm processing in real time. Yeah. Tell me about your thoughts about so everything you've talked about is I think possible. I haven't looked at free cash flows and free cash flow yields, but assuming you're right, and I assume you are, it all checks out. What about the question of volatility of prices, the actual commodity prices themselves? Because cigarette companies don't have volatile tobacco prices to deal with, or if they do, it's relatively moderate and they control it and that kind of stuff. Yeah. If the oil price goes to $40 and $200 and $40 and $200 multiple times over your holding period, It's not just a straight line decline of free cash flows, even if they are. It's a question of what happens. Those cash flows will be volatile during that period of time. And if they spend long periods of time at low oil prices, which frankly as a motorist I desperately hope will be true. What your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so you do have to have a bit of a macro view. And mine would be that we're actually probably going to have a bit of a supply shortage. Just because of no one's, and this isn't something that's just happened since Ukraine. Like there's actually been massive underinvestment in recent years.
Right.
So there's just, and these aren't things that you can just, press a button and it takes a long time to sort of ramp this kind of stuff up.
Yeah.
Okay. So I don't know that there will be a big supply. So I think energy price, this is why I'm also quite worried about inflation. I think that energy is the basis of our entire economy. I don't think we're going to see low. We might see prices lower than where they are now, but I think the days of cheap energy are just long gone. Huh. And we've got this huge infrastructure spend as we do trend. So eventually, when we make the transition, and we've built out all the infrastructure, we will have abundant cheap power, and it'll be great. It'll be a really great world to live in. But that's a decade-long, multi-decade-long process. So for a reasonably long period of time, I think we're going to have above average prices. One risk would be the government risk, which we've seen happen, where they sort of say, actually going to charge you increased royalties on that. But they'll still, Woodside Energy is on an 8.5% yield. It's on a PE of 8 point something. Right. And they're not. So again, assuming that all they do is go, right, well, we're just going to sell what we can. We're making super normal profits at the moment. And we're just going to pay you out in big fat dividends and buy our share. Buying shares back is always going to help. But when buying your shares back at very, very low multiples, it really helps.
That is the secret of reinvested dividends and share buybacks are the secret of long term outperformance for the cigarette companies and others, right? So you did it right.
So he's laying it out. It's like, a company that has the ability to generate high margin sales for at least the next 5 or 10 years, probably more certainly over the next 3 to 5 years, very, very high dividend yield on the interim. I mean, again, I'm just picking on Woodside just because it's a better known company. Don't run out and buy it because of what I'm saying. It's 100% frank. So I'm actually getting more than a 10% yield on right?
Grossed up,
It's not going to take long for me to actually pay back my entire investment with that, especially if with increasing profits, we're going to see increasing dividends that might go up 3 or 4% a year. I'll probably get my money back in 5 or 6 years entirely through dividends, and the rest of it is just money for jam on top of that. So it's this is a thought bubble that it strikes me as the. In a world where everyone is shunning this stuff because of ESG, in a world of structurally higher energy prices, in a world of nervousness around reinvestment of bringing on new capacity, it strikes me as something that, again, the key thing here is to have management who's on the same page, because there'll be some management just silly, and they go, we're building a new well because that's what we do. Yeah. It's like, but the economics aren't great. The optics aren't great. Yeah, we're doing it anyway. That's okay. Not going yet. But if someone goes, it's like that. This is the genius of the tobacco companies, right? One in their incredibly effective propaganda campaigns. like they were very good at that. But also because they saw the writing on the wall and they said, okay, well, we're going to stop investing in new things and we're going to pay all our shareholders out as much cash as we can. Again, there's a huge ethical elephant in the room, and I don't want to ignore that. But in this instance, let's ignore it. From a pure, I'm trying to maximize my returns. I feel as though there's a play to be had there.
Nice. So look, you know very well my view on ethical investing, whether you own them or don't own them. I don't expect the company to do anything different, and it doesn't mean you have to feel icky about it or not. But I would happily disregard the ethical investing issues on your behalf, but recognise you won't. Mate, the oil price is higher than it's been almost any time except for before it came for inflation, the period between 2007, 2008.
Yeah.
So I think your thesis is right. I won't be doing what you suggest, and the reason I won't be doing it is because I don't... I would suppose, with nothing to back me up, that things will remain more cyclical than your hypothesis suggests. Mm. And I would imagine, if I was going to be a betting man, that let's say for fun, let's bet a bottle of red wine on this just for fun. I reckon the price over the next 5 years, the weighted average price of the next 5 years is lower than the current price. We've been made bet. Just outright, right? And I do think... the supply one is, you're absolutely right. I don't know the answer to that. Other than, as much as the big guys aren't doing it, there's lots of little guys out there trying desperately to find more oil. I spoke to one oil company executive. We're actually going to have him on the Good Oil podcast soon. I'm not a big energy investor either, but I had an interesting chat with him, and because of the way he described it, I was like, that's interesting. I'd like our listeners to hear it. So we're going to do a Good Oil episode on it. But they're desperately trying to find oil all around the world. Others are doing the same. The other thing that gets me, why I really struggle with energy, mate, the one thing that kind of keeps me on the sidelines a little bit is, or everything you've talked about is absolutely true. When you talk about government, though, the biggest swing factor or potential swing factor in the world is the OPEC cartel.
Yeah.
Because... with the oil price now over $100 a barrel, their cost of getting it out of the ground is routinely suggested to be single digits or very, very low double digit per dollars per barrel.
Mm.
So if your cost base, because it's so plentiful, so accessible in the Middle East, if your cost base is literally $8, $10, $12, $15 a barrel, and you can produce, they could double their output tomorrow at that same price or close enough to it. They don't because they want to keep some sort of global scarcity, and that supports your thesis, by the way. Mm. But the flick of a pen from a bureaucrat or a what do you call it? What sort of crat is it when there's a royal family involved? Is it a monocrat? Monocrat. Let's go with that.
Monocrat.
It's fun. Yeah. No, it's not really. It's made it up. But yeah, when someone says, "Let's increase the amount of oil," then the price comes tumbling down. Or when they say, "Nah, let's shut the tap off," it goes up. I find that, to me, like, I just, of all the things, it's a bit like sovereign risk in a different kind of way. They could literally change the entire oil supply demand dynamic over the next whatever period of time. So I don't know. I wouldn't take the other side of your bet, by the way. I wouldn't get involved in the bet because I just don't know. Your thinking, by the way, is not miles away from why I bought Fortescue shares back in whatever it was last year.
Right.
But I feel personally, better about oil than energy because of that unknown kind of macro-y, geopolitical-y kind of whatever conversation that we're having.
Yeah, I see. This is the thing, and I want to be clear here. It's a thought that's been percolating around. Like, I don't even know if I'll do it.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think it's a really interesting. Interesting thought. And of course, any investment that I lay out is gonna have risks. And you're right to sort of highlight the right ones.
Yeah, that's super.
But yeah, I just thought it's an interesting thing. I think so often there is the as we've discussed before, being contrarian for the sake of being contrarian is just dumb.
Yeah.
But there is value in thinking when everyone is thinking one thing,
that's right,
and they are convinced of it, it's sometimes worth taking the other view and going, well, maybe there's another angle here. And in fact, you can agree with a lot of the bears. We'd sort of say, it's an industry in decline, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But all of that was the lesson of the tobacco industry, right? And it just strikes me that there's huge parallels there. Yeah. So anyway, food for thought, food for thought.
Motley Fool Money. For more, subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener.
Let's, 40 minutes into the podcast, start talking about stuff we thought we'd talk about. Let's go to, speaking of food for thought, speaking of reasons to get a little energised. Crown Casino, Crown Entertainment, Crown Resorts, whatever they're called these days. As of tomorrow our time, but today in podcast time, so on Friday, will be owned by Blackstone. Blackstone is buying Crown. The shares have been suspended for a while. They formally take possession apparently tomorrow. And they get to take possession at a time when Crown has been granted the license to operate a casino in Barangaroo, which is a newly formed kind of mini suburb location in Sydney. On the harbour there, James Packer's massive, great new skyscraper, which is both a beautiful building and an absolute abomination on the shoreline, in my view, but that's just me.
It looks like Stark Tower for any Marvel fans that are out there.
Have you been to Barangaroo?
Expect Iron Man to fly out the roof or something. Yeah, Barangaroo's, it's actually...
How lovely is the parkland?
Yeah, it's lovely, yeah.
So they've done a really nice... partial credit to the city planners. James Packer got to put up a massive, great skyscraper. We like to put metal and steel things on shorelines, which I think is a real shame. If you look at old photos of Sydney where it actually had some green stuff, it was quite nice. But obviously, as part of that the city planners have demanded, required some parkland be actually put on the headland, which is actually really lovely. So full credit to them for at least getting that as part of the development. Not convinced it was net a win, but that part of it's really lovely. Barangaroo, a new big building, hotel, shopping center, and until now, no casino. Turns out, after all of the allegations, and I want to say allegedly a few times, after all the allegations that were made about Crown, some of them proven, some of them maybe not, I'm not sure where they all landed, about the way they operated their casino in other parts of the country, in the context of Star Entertainment, literally across the harbour from Barangaroo, having its own inquiry and own damning evidence being given, the regulator decided that Crown deserves a casino license. And I'm a little bit flabbergasted. I tweeted during the week, and Andrew, I know you liked that tweet, that I'm not sure what you would have to do to lose a casino. If everything we've heard over the past couple of years about everything that's been wrong with the casino industry, I think we can say industry because the only two listed or big listed, there's another third one, the only two big listed casino operators are both being dragged through inquiries and as said, in the face of damning evidence. And they were seen to be, by the various regulators, not fit to run a casino. So they let them run the casino. No, yeah. You didn't mishear that. They said, well, you guys aren't fit to run a casino, so we'll give you some time to get fit to run a casino.
Mm.
Now, I don't know what a license is worth, and I don't know what conditions you would have to, what lines you would have to cross to actually lose a license these days. It seems like one of those, you have to be licensed, you have a social obligation, but if you don't discharge it, we'll whack you over the I was going to say with a wet lettuce, maybe a wet cabbage these days. Lettuce is hard to come by. You got to whack with a wet bit of cabbage, and then we'll tell you to fix up your act. You got a couple of years to do it and go on minting a small fortune, fleecing the punters of Australia and overseas. That's reasonably jaundiced view of casino operators and casinos. But I don't know, Ram, what would you need to do to lose a casino license in Australia these days?
I don't know. Maybe
money laundering,
start, like,
check. Not bothering
killing people
ID,
on
check.
The floor. I don't know.
Giving false statements to governments and banks. Check. What else? Yeah, if your job isn't to be a responsible, receiver and transmitter of money, and you screw that up, and that's your core business, and they go, no, it's okay. No worries. Keep going.
Yeah.
I don't know what you got to do to lose one.
Look, there are some nuances here. So, and some people in that tweet replied to you. It's like, well, actually, they've sold it, so it's a new owner, and also they had to, meet certain conditions in order to be re-granted, and they've now met those conditions and the rest of it. But I do think there's a little bit of semantics in all of that. At the end of the day, they were very allegedly poor operators. I don't know what you have to do. I really don't. Get it. The argument always comes back to, but it creates lots of jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And I go, okay, well, let's have a heroin industry. That'll create lots of jobs. Look, imagine the
you have
revenue.
To say hashtag sarcasm. That otherwise someone's going to cop, out of context. And
it's a highly addictive product, right? We can make it from poppy seeds. So it's really, really high margin, highly addictive product. We'll get the whole state, and we'll make a fortune.
Got to ruin some lives, mate. But it's worth it, right?
Look at the jobs. I mean, all the dealers have to support their families, and all the processors and the mules. It's just sort of like, obviously, at a point it gets ridiculous. Yeah. So the fact that some economic activity employs people is not a good enough argument in and of itself, right?
Can I add to that too, mate? Because you're exactly right. I don't want to spoil your comment, but it's not. We're not even saying those people would be put out of a job, or that we're not. You're not calling. Well, we might be separately. Not calling for the end of the casino industry. We're just saying that operator shouldn't be allowed to operate a casino, potentially, if they were to break some certain rules. And again, we're not legal eagles. We don't want commissioners. We're on those those inquiries, but. If you said tomorrow, Page Incorporated can't run the casino, the government's got to say, hey, who'd like to run a casino? And Scott Incorporated says, I'll do it, please. And they go, okay, cool. Mm. So the job's not even to say go away. The casino's shut for 2 weeks. And you reopen it and you say, Crown, you can no longer run a casino. Go and do whatever else you want. You're no longer a casino operator or Star or anybody else. We'll give it to somebody else. The casino, you can take the casino away, but it doesn't even need to go away. You just literally say, that building over there with its roulette wheels can be sold to somebody else to run the business.
Yeah.
Because you can't run anymore. You're not allowed to run anymore. But bad luck, you're out.
Yeah.
It's not that hard.
Yeah.
It reminds I was thinking about the geographic area, right? And so this is a really random example, but I was thinking about the area of Sydney. Bridge climb. Climb the Harbour Bridge.
Yeah.
That facility has the right to run that operation was granted to one operator.
Mm.
That right was taken away from the operator and has been given to somebody else.
Mm.
That's it. The bridge. No one stopped people climbing on the bridge.
Yeah.
The bridge wasn't. That company wasn't told. Well, you've got 5 years to be able to run it better. Instead, I mean, they didn't lose it because they ran it badly. By the way, it was just one of those kind of tender things.
Mm.
Why shouldn't we, as a state, as a country, say to a casino operator, you have a right to run that site for as long as you remain a fit and proper person. When you stop being that, we'll give it to somebody else.
Mm.
Tell me that wouldn't focus the mind.
I don't disagree with you at all. It just boggles. It really does boggle the mind. It really does. And as we said before, like when Crown was in the news originally, and you kind of think, you'd think Sydney Casino would be sort of the Star would be sweating bullets.
Yeah.
Geez, we better get our house on order. And in the meanwhile, they're just doing allegedly the same kind of thing. It's like, gosh,
and literally with the same outcomes of you guys are very, very bad boys and girls. You're not fit to run a casino, so keep running it and just improve, will you?
Dude, it's like if I'm selling drugs out of my two-bedroom unit and the bloke next door is selling drugs out of it and he gets busted, I'm probably going to pull my head in and just keep it on the down low for a little bit, right? Like just... I should come up with better analogies. But it's still, it's kind of like, you know, I feel as though it's the incentives are too great for this not to be the outcome. Again, Charlie Munger, show me the incentives, I'll show you the outcome.
Yeah.
If you are familiar with the casino business, I love a bit of a flutter. I'll go in, throw $50 on a blackjack table or play some poker. It's a bit of fun. I don't know why. It's really dumb. I'm just going to... I might as well just torch my money. And I hardly ever do it. But I'm not a Puritan that says thou shalt not ever do what you like. Fill your boots. I don't care. I'm not one of those people. But I'm not the kind of person, and people like that are not the people that keep the business going.
Yeah,
you know, it's the problem gamblers
the addicts,
that really do all of the heavy lifting. It's the same with poker machines.
Yeah.
So for people to go, oh, but you're against this, like, well, no, I'm against exploitation. And I'm against particularly against exploitation of society's most vulnerable. So, you know, you want to have gambling facilities? Fantastic. Well, how about we put a limit on that for each person? There is a whole spectrum of gray between the black and the white ends.
Well, the red and the black, as the case might be, if you're playing.
The red and the black in this instance. Yes, very boom. Anyway, it is very depressing. And it goes to show you that you know, powerful, rich entities get held to a different account. You know, I've dug this hole now, let's go with it. You know, if I'm dealing drugs out the front of Crown and I get busted, you know, maybe arguably the damage I'm causing is far less than what's going on in the building. I'm going to suffer far greater penalties than the person who's persecuting harm at a you know, 10x level.
That's what annoys me. Imagine you're stealing cars and they go, oh, right. Well, look, you shouldn't be stealing cars. Just keep stealing cars till you learn not to steal cars anymore, will you?
Can I have a chance to prove that I won't? Yeah.
You've got 2 years to stop stealing cars. And after that, if you haven't stopped stealing cars in 2 years, then we'll take some serious action.
That's exactly what it is.
That's bizarre. Yeah. Mates, we're running out of time. Let's open a new can of worms. Stamp duty on land taxes. You love a bit of property. You suggest this topic and I said, yeah, good idea. And now as I'm bringing it up, I'm thinking, oh, he just wanted to rant about property again. And I've fallen straight in your trap and now I've even introduced the topic, so I'm completely trapped. I'm a mug. I've been played for one. Interesting this week, the New South Wales government decided to implement a program allowing first home buyers to, instead of paying an upfront lump sum of stamp duty, often in the tens of thousands of dollars, in fact, almost always in the tens of thousands of dollars, for properties up to $1.5 million, which is a one-bedroom unit in Blacktown or something. First home buyers can choose to pay instead $400 a year plus 0.3% of the land value every single year. A plan that apparently means a break-in is about 13 years. So if you had decided to pay the land tax, if you're still there in 14 years, you've gone backwards, you've actually lost on the deal. If you buy a place, pay land tax for 5 or 6 years, then leave, you've actually saved yourself some money on what you would have paid in land tax. Now, I'm going to say before I ask you up front, mate, I think there's a bit of political fig leafery going on here. When this was proposed by then Treasurer Perrottet, now Premier Perrottet, it was suggested as for every transaction, for everybody, optional, but once it was in place, it was locked onto that property forever. And so eventually the entire state's real estate income stream would move from stamp duty on sale to land tax on the purchase, on any property owned in New South Wales. So it was this budget transforming, income producing growth tax, because let's be honest, the prices are always going to keep going up. It was supposed to be some sort of way for the government to future-proof its income stream and its funding. And it was this kind of budget measure to revolutionise state funding. It's turned into the same thing by name, land tax rather than stamp duty, but now it's a very, 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 very watered down quasi-affordability measure for first home buyers only up to a certain dollar value. So I'm gonna start by saying I think this is a political fig leaf where they've said, no, we haven't junked the policy. See, I told you we're going to do it. It's like it bears almost no resemblance to what was originally proposed.
Yeah.
But also, I think this is what you're going to say, it doesn't help affordability at all.
Yeah. It doesn't. And I guess it's hard because you almost have to take a step back here because you get into philosophy and ideology pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So, on one side, they would say, well, the trouble with the stamp duty is it makes us much less flexible. You know, it means that I just copped with a tax every time I move. don't we want our workforce to be far more mobile? Like, shouldn't I, again, if you're looking at an economy and there happens to be more jobs in, Dubbo as opposed to Tamworth or something like that, it's like, well, why are we we want people to move and make it as frictionless as possible. Also, there's the idea of sort of, redistribution in the sense that the mega wealthy maybe should pay a greater sum to the society that has treated them so well, et cetera, et cetera. And, someone who's living in a $20 million mansion probably should pay a little bit more. And if they never move, they never pay any tax on that kind of thing. So there's sort of economic arguments and I want to say at the start, I don't know if I've ever landed hard on one side or the other. I'm in this annoying person who kind of thinks there's good points made on both sides.
Yeah,
What do I think? Yes, I think it's sort of like you're so often the case, there is a definite sensible debate to be had here and it probably started out from one of those things. And then, as you said, it's just sort of changed so much as to sort of be, okay.
It's almost unrecognizable versus the policy that was originally proposed. I mean, there might be some land tax paid by some taxpayers in some circumstances should they choose, but that's about as close as the two policies get to each other.
Yeah. And there's also unintended consequences. So
that's a good point.
My mother-in-law is a good example here. Probably classes asset rich, income poor. She doesn't have 2 cents to rub together, but she's lived in a house for 30 years that, has since gone up a gazillion percent.
Yeah.
Like every other boomer. And if a land tax was introduced, she wouldn't be able to pay it.
Yeah.
She just wouldn't be able to. And then again, you could kind of say, oh, well, sell a property then, and do it that way, which I don't know what my firm view is on all of this stuff, but there are a lot of unintended consequences just because you live there. I just look in my area too. It's sort of like, just as like in most of Sydney, the property values have gone through the roof, but there's a lot of elderly people around here. Again, I don't imagine are wealthy in any normal stretch of the imagination, except the fact that their asset, that their home, the family home, has gone up many orders of magnitude. And again, maybe that's fair enough. It's just like, should we have sympathy for the multi millionaire there who just doesn't want to sell their house? I mean, you could always say, "Well, sell it," and then downsize, and you'll have millions of dollars, and you're far richer than someone like me who's renting and doesn't have that underneath them. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm talking around in circles here, but I guess I'm saying it's nuanced, it's complicated, and it's tricky.
Yeah, I've got rather more strident views on this, mate. I think that, let's first principles, I think that we have a government financing problem writ large in Australia. And I think the best solution to that is for the wealthy and probably companies to pay more tax, which doesn't make me popular among our listeners or our members because a lot of them are one of those two categories. But so be it. My job is to call it straight, not to pander to people, so I'm not going to. So let's start with that. I think stamp duty is a very inefficient tax. But I think stamp duty has two advantages over land tax. And these are behavioral as much as real. And this is where I get into trouble. I'm not getting trouble. I get in arguments with classical economists, right? What does stamp duty do? Stamp duty, so you mentioned mobility. It's absolutely true that if you've got to pay large lump sums to move houses, you're less likely to do so. What does it also mean? It means that we're not going to have, touch wood, the same sort of property speculation, despite what you might think about the property market in Australia being overheated, and it is. You can't flip properties if you've got to pay 25 or 50 grand each time you do it. Or if you do, you've got to have there's a very, very big disincentive to do so. So people in America who bought 2, 3, or 4 properties and tried to flip them for an immediate profit and whatever in the pre-GFC or what caused the GFC largely, it's actually a disincentive to move in and out of housing too quickly. I also think, for what it's worth, mate, that as much as I agree with your Tamworth to Dubbo disincentive and mobility thing, I actually think, and again, I'm a finance guy, but I think we let the economists get too much say on that one. Because if you want to move from Dubbo to Tamworth, knock yourself out. But when we think about people as economic units of production that should be shuffled around the country at a whim because that's what we think is best for the economy, I actually think we missed the point. Yeah, if you've got family ties, if you want to move from Tamworth, Dubbo, knock yourself out. Great towns. Go, and then go back. Do whatever you want. I moved from Sydney to Barrel and you saw the Southern Highlands. You know, would I like to do that without a stamp duty? Sure. That'd be nice. But, you know, if there's a job going in the Adelaide Hills or in Cairns or whatever, and I want to take it, great. But to imagine that we have a unit of production that's unutilized in Barrel and a piece of, you know, potential production that needs a unit of production up in Cairns, all you do is connect those two dots and to hell with the social implications. I actually think that's a bit rugged. So I think for me, I don't buy the economic mobility thing as a justification. Economically, in the models, knock yourself out. Society-wise, socially, I'm not entirely sure that's something we should be aiming for. I think we can be a little bit more generous, a little bit more thoughtful than that. And while I'm on the economically kind of versus socially thing, I reckon tipping a pensioner out of their house who can't afford land tax is a really, really crap thing to do. I just, you know, yes, they're in expensive housing. Yes, the benefit from house price rises, all that kind of stuff. And again, purely economically, sure. And that, well, I've had arguments on Twitter with young people who just, you know, boomers suck, death to all boomers, you know, they should just have to move out of their house, screw them, they're in the way. The quicker they get out of the way, the better. And that's just a really, really crap thing to talk about, right? You know, boomers are people too. As our millennials and Gen X. And remember Gen X? Remember us, you bastards? We exist too. It's not just about you millennials and you boomers.
The best generation.
Clearly. But yeah, I just think, like, really, like, if the best solution to our economic problems are to kick pensions out of their homes by putting up a land tax they can't afford, if that's literally the best solution we've got as a country, man, we've fallen a decent way. Like, you know, and some people maybe should. Your mother-in-law, my mum, mum's been in her place for 40-something years. It's not a particularly expensive place, but she, you know, she could probably, it's only a three-bedroom place, she could probably downsize to a unit or something and maybe make some money. Should we kick her out of her home just because she can't afford a land tax and kind of, you know, incentivize in air quotes, someone to sell their home so they can pay a bill they otherwise haven't allowed for? I just think it's a really crappy way to run a country, run a society. So, like, you know, economically, maybe, I just reckon we've got to be able to find better solutions than that. That can't be the best we can all come up with collectively. So, yeah, I have actually a really massive issue with the land tax as an issue. I have no issue with removing stamp duty, by the way. I think the bigger issue is probably the way we fund government services more broadly. And I think states only have limited amounts of ways to raise money. And so they do it by saying, well, we've got some choices here. We sell a crap load of property every year, or we can tax a crap load of property every year. Let's do that and try and fund the government coffers. There's probably an argument to say that we can think about better ways of funding the overall government services, and maybe there's a better way, a third way. You know, we kind of let politicians do that. It's like with removal of petrol excise, right? Mm. People say, we've got to charge EV users because we're losing petrol excise. As if charging a vehicle per kilometre driven is the only way we can raise money for the government, and the removal of 1 cent per kilometre or cents per litre charge has to be replaced with a cents per kilometre or cents per gigawatt charge because it has to be a one-for-one. It's like, we're kind of more imaginative than that, surely, aren't we?
I agree. I've been thinking a lot lately about path dependency and this idea of, well, things are the way they are because of history, right? Like, we didn't... Mm. If we were colonizing Mars, maybe with Elon's help, we will.
Helping their quotes, yeah.
I'm being a little facetious there, but we would have started from first principles designing. Yeah, right. I think we would end up with lots of debates, and but we would end up with something radically different.
Dare I say better?
Because there are so many things that are just so terrible. But it's all, we've always done it that way, and we've kind of all, and it's just change. There's a lot of inertia in the system. Yeah. It's just very hard to change it. People are used to it. You know, whenever you make change, someone is getting the short end of the stick, right? Mm-hmm. There's always someone who's going to get, someone's going to be better off after the change, and someone's going to be worse off. And so it's just very, 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 very difficult. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, this is what's hard. I think this is, to your point, really, is that the economists probably make some really great points here.
Yeah.
But they forget sort of like the human element of it sometimes, perhaps. And B, they just
generous,
they don't
sometimes
they
perhaps.
Don't they don't recognize this path dependence that we have on so many different things.
Yep.
You know, anyone who's out there who's ever worked for a big organization will know exactly what I'm talking about. You get your new job, And you go, right, Scott, welcome to Page Industries Proprietary Limited.
Yeah,
your job is to do this thing. And you go, oh, okay, cool. Hey, why don't we do it like this? This would be like really fast and easier. And Jerry's like, no, we've never done it that way. Yeah, but we could. Like, there's no law of the universe. Yeah, we've just never done it that way. And it just, it's the most maddening thing in the world. But it's also.
I laugh because I've been there. Go on.
It's society, right? Yeah, it's not just you and your job. And everyone will be able to think of examples where you look at something from a first principles perspective and it's madness. Like, why do we do it that way? That's the value, I think, one of the values of traveling. When you go to a different country. Yes. And they go, oh yeah, we always do it this way. And you go, what? What you mean? There's a different way. Oh, and people are totally cool with that.
Yeah,
you know, and the amount of stuff that we accept as just the way that the universe is, until you have something that comes to an end, and there's this big, massive structural change. Yeah. Usually, a whole bunch of pain that goes with it. But you know, I don't know. I don't know what my point is. My only point is that. There's a lot of maddening, stupid stuff in the world, but it's there for a reason. Not a good reason.
Exactly. Yeah.
Let me say this. The good reason is just because of path dependency and historical, you know, how we've sort of landed there.
Yeah.
But in any other, I'm old enough to recognize this is never going to happen, but
yes,
I would love for us all as a, even like to reform our political institutions, you know, everything from in tax and corporations law, and just I think we would come up with a much better system given what we know today, rather than what some white male thought, you know, 90 years ago was a great idea, and that we've just
200
done
years ago, right?
Like probably 200-300 years ago.
Your point about companies is great because it starts with, I mean, you know, stamp duty was literally a duty on a stamp. Which, you know, literally no longer exists. Corporations were invented to, you know, to fund the Dutch East India Trading Company in 1800 and whatever.
Yep.
And path dependency is a really good point in that, because not only would we change what we do, but we make changes to current institutions. We don't work out what's best. So why don't we just change this thing here? Why don't we put tax rates up or down a little bit because that seems like a good idea, rather than that tax is dumb or that tax is great.
Yeah.
I think stamp duty is a terrible idea, generally speaking. I think land tax is worse and... Government's looking at it saying, well, what sort of property tax should we have? So, well, who said we should have a property tax? Which is exactly your point about path dependency. We're saying, if we're going to replace, take off, you know, if we take off stamp duty, maybe we should have a pineapple tax or a, you know, tree tax or a, I mean, I'm being stupid deliberately, you know, or a kilometres walk tax. Or like, that doesn't matter. Like, that whole idea of like, how would we raise money to run a state government is the question, rather than how should we change one sort of property tax or another sort of property tax to solve a problem.
It's amazing. And just one quick thing, because for this episode that we're going to struggle to make 40 minutes, we're now an hour and 8 minutes into. I think where I made the point before. I think that's when you really do get the great entrepreneurs. Now, they've often got personalities mixed in with that, and those personalities can be questionable and crazy. Mm. But, you know, like the Steve Jobs, the Elon Musks, and the reason that they just do things differently. Mm. And as you go, actually, why do I need a button on my smartphone? I need an on and off and a volume.
That's right.
I don't need one. And it's like, but every phone has heaps of buttons. That's how you do things. No, I don't.
That works.
You don't want one.
Yeah.
Another guy goes, oh, let's not. Why do we have this internal combustion engine? Electric engines are far more efficient. There's much more torque. There's okay, let's do that. Hey, let's have rockets that like land themselves. Why are we building these hundreds of millions of dollars worth of machinery and then we dump them in the ocean and start again? Like, that seems really stupid. Let's start from first principles.
Yeah.
And there's a million other examples, like Henry Ford and the production line, if you want to go, you know, a gazillion other things.
Yeah, totally.
Hey, why do we read on these bits of tree? Why don't we just have an electronic screen, a Kindle? Like, let's do that. Let's start interacting online. Like, all of the great leaps forward come from people who just chuck out
working
the orthodoxy.
In office, mate. Why do we work in an office? Because we always have.
Once you start looking, examples are everywhere.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I think it's interesting. There's a lot of the companies that I own. I feel as though they're doing it within their tiny little niche industries. Mm-hmm. You know, hey, we always used to do it this way. Well, we can do it like 10 times faster, better, cheaper. And I'm always too early with these investments because you look at it and go, oh my God, this is going to take the world by storm.
Yeah.
And like even in some instances where that's been true and I've done really well, it's kind of like, it takes like 5 years for the rest of the world to catch on. Not because the rest of, you know, I'm some visionary and the rest of the world can't see. It's not that. Absolutely, it's not that. It's because of the inertia that is just within systems, and the pain of change and the uncertainty around. It's why I love the saying, I'm going to get it wrong, but it's something like change always takes longer to happen than you think possible, and then moves quicker than you thought was ever likely. Something like that, in which case you sort of see these things like the internet or like smartphones or, you know, dare I say, Bitcoin, where you see these things that kind of like, wow, here's this really novel way of doing something.
This podcast too long.
It's going to get in there. It seems inevitable, right? And then 10 years later, it's kind of like it's only now just getting started. And then in the next 10 years, it all changes at once. And it's just the story of humanity.
Mate, you can drive. We talk about the podcast about the arc of progress, right? You can drive a Tesla down the street, but the printer still looks like it was invented in 1986.
Yeah, crazy, right?
Crazy. Speaking of things that should be innovated, the length of this podcast. Why are we still talking? Because we are. Let's take the spirit of disruption and innovation, mate, and say, you know what? We've probably done enough. Just because we started talking doesn't mean we should keep talking. We will stop talking, and we will come back instead on Sunday if you'd be so kind as to join me.
Oh, you know it. Absolutely.
Until then, full on.
Cheers.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services Licence 400691. Listener.